This is One-on-One with Mark Monty on 1070 The Fan. Brought to you by Georgetown Market, Indy's family-owned natural food store since 1973. Movie Time Video Productions, they make your memories last forever. And Dr. Gary Walton, dentistry with a personal touch.
He and his brothers grew up poor, sons of a humble tailor, living in a cramped apartment in the Bronx. And together, they wrote a classic American success story. A twist of fate brought his oldest brother to Indianapolis for military duty, and he followed years later to join him in the real estate world. They started a business in 1960 and methodically built an empire that became the largest public real estate company in the United States and spread throughout the world. Without these two brothers, downtown Indianapolis would be a shell of its current self, and the Pacers probably would be playing out of Sacramento, because they bought the franchise when it was on the brink of moving, not because they wanted to own an NBA team, but out of civic pride. Through their business interests and charitable contributions, they became two of the most influential people in the city's history. With the recent passing of his oldest brother, he's now the sole owner of the Pacers, and he's more involved than ever in trying to make them a winning team again. I'm Mark Monteith, and today I'm going one-on-one with Herb Simon.
One-on-one today is coming to you from the Pacer offices. It's a Friday afternoon, and tonight Mel Simon will be honored by the franchise and a banner raised in his honor. And I had the pleasure of talking with Herb, Mel's younger brother. And Herb, you were born in Brooklyn, raised in the Bronx.
Right.
Your father was a tailor.
Yes.
Would it be fair to say you guys grew up poor, or was it a middle-class situation, or what was the environment?
We were probably poor, but we didn't realize it at the time.
Yeah.
Because we always had something to eat, but it was very modest.
Was your father an immigrant, or had he...
He was an immigrant. My mother was born in the country, but she was a first generation. He was an immigrant.
Okay, where did he come from?
He came from somewhere that was at one time called Austria-Hungary, but it was probably closer to Poland. Somewhere near Krakow.
So this is a classic American story of an immigrant coming with nothing and becoming a tailor and starting a family and the whole thing.
Yes, and he got to realize some of it in his later years. We moved him out to Indianapolis, and he saw what Mel and I and Freddie were doing, so he got to see his boys, as he called us.
What was the environment like in the household? I mean, were you in a cramped area? Was it small space?
We had a three-room, not a three-bedroom, but a three-room apartment for five of us, my mother, my father, Freddie, Mel, and I. And so it was one bedroom, one combination room that was a bedroom for some of the boys and a living room and a kitchen. And one bathroom.
A family gets close that way, doesn't it?
Very close.
So the three boys are all sharing a bedroom, I take it.
Well, for a while I had to sleep in my mother's room and my father's room for a while, but then I got to share the room with my brother.
So okay, because you're the youngest,
I'm
right?
I'm the youngest, yeah.
Okay. That must have been kind of crazy, having three boys growing up in a small space like that. I mean, you must have some fond memories of what that was like as kids.
Well, it was our age differences were so great that Melvin was never around because he was 8 years older than me, and Freddie was around, but there always seemed to be enough room. We never seemed to be crowded.
Now, Freddie, was he the middle
child? Yes.
Okay. Did you get picked on a lot by your older brothers?
No, as a matter of fact, Melvin sometimes had a temper, but Fred became my bodyguard, and he kept me safe on the streets. He was always a strong, strapping young man, even when he was a youngster, so no one would really mess with me if they knew Brother Freddie was going to back me up.
What was it like on the streets in Brooklyn growing up there?
Brooklyn, I don't remember. I was 9 months old
okay,
when we moved.
Okay, the Bronx.
The Bronx was, you know, we were all day out in the streets, playing in the streets, dodging cars, which were not that many at the time, playing the sports that kids would play.
Stickball?
Punch ball, stickball, hide and seek and things.
I would guess you have a lot of fond memories of your childhood, just because you were always active, there were always kids around, and you didn't worry about how much money the family had or anything like that?
Well, no, as a matter of fact, there were times when I would, as a young kid, when I heard my parents worrying about money, I would take that worry to bed with me and worry about it. But they always managed to get through, and we always had food on the table. So
that's what counts. Now, so you were a sports fan growing up?
Well, yes, I was. I played all the sports, and of course, the Yankees were big at that time, and that was one of my recreations. I remember the couple of times my father took me to the Yankee Stadium, which was like walking distance from my house, mile away. And I remember my brother Mel taking me to the basketball games in the old Madison Square Garden.
Right.
So, right. Yes, sports was part of our.
Okay, so you were a basketball fan growing up.
Yes. Yeah.
And did you play sports in high school? Did you compete on the teams? Or?
No. Okay. Just in the streets with in my neighborhood.
Were you kids, did you guys get in trouble much? Not serious things, but were you ornery?
Fred was the one who used to get in trouble. He broke more arms and legs by fighting or falling or jumping.
Yeah.
So my father used to worry about Fred. Mel and I rarely got into trouble.
Was your father kind of a strict disciplinarian type of guy?
I wouldn't say he was strict, but he was always concerned about us. Mm-hmm. And always checking on us and making sure we wouldn't get into trouble. But I can't say he was very strict.
If I had talked to you when you're growing up in the Bronx as a kid and asked you what you wanted to do with your life then, what would you have said?
I would not know what to say, to be honest with you. I told the story about and at Mel's funeral that my father did speak to Melvin, the oldest, and told him two things. Number one, he told him to get a good education. And he told him to make sure you take care of your brothers. And Melvin really did that. All his life, he was always trying to get his jobs or bringing us together. And so he listened to my father's advice. And as I said at his funeral, even then, my father knew that Freddie and I needed help. And we got great help from Melvin.
Well, he seems like the classic older brother, a pretty powerful personality. And
exuberant is the word.
Mel came to Indianapolis because of the Army in 1953, 54. Do you recall that time in his life and what it was like for him to go off and leave the family and go out to this strange city in the Midwest?
Well, it wasn't such a great departure because Melvin was always so active that I rarely saw him around the house. Uh-huh. Even when he lived with us, he was always out selling or learning or going to seminars. And So his leaving for Indianapolis wasn't that much of a departure. But I had just graduated college at the time, and he kept calling me and saying, "You got to come out to Indiana. It's the world, land of opportunity." And I kept saying, "Come on, I'm from New York. I don't have to come out to Indiana." But then around 1960, I fell in love and decided to get married. And I realized I probably could make a good living in New York. And he kept asking me to come out, and then I came out and I joined him. He got me a job with the Albert Frankel Company, which is a local real estate company. And then it was a short-term job that Mr. Frankel agreed to pay me $100 a week for 6 months, and that was it. So somewhat shortly after that, by the way, Melvin was making the same $100 a week, but he was into commission, so he had some money. And then it was getting too much for Mr. Frankel because we were starting to get, Melvin especially, was starting to get options all over and making deals all over. And we amicably left and started our own company in June of 1960.
Now, did you have a particular interest in real estate before you got out here?
Not really.
Not really?
I just, it was just a matter of, I followed Melvin around for a couple of years and you know, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to be a good developer. You have to work hard, get lucky, and smile once in a while.
What had you studied in college?
Business. Accounting and business.
And Mel, I take it, had done the same thing, basically?
I think he had a little bit more real estate and accounting and business.
And you say he told you this is the land of opportunity. Why was that? He just saw that there was going to be a lot of growth?
He fell in love also and decided to stay here and get married to a local girl, and at that time he was in the Army, he had plenty of free time, and instead of going out and drinking, he went out and explored opportunities. Mm-hmm. And when he saw the start of the retail shopping center business through the Frankel Company, they were leasing agents on Eastgate, that was way back then, and Southern Plaza, and he started to see these kind of opportunities, and he was always a family and my brother Mel, and he always remembered what his father told him, so he kept getting us, you know, involved, and we just joined him. First I did, and a couple of years later Freddie came out.
You say you started at $100 a week. What were you doing for your $100 a week?
I was making leases, in shopping centers, and also looking for properties to sell. I remember I worked on one deal for like long after they stopped paying me before I made a service station site, which I optioned at one price and sold at another price. It took a long time.
Okay.
My first real deal.
Yeah, that had to be satisfying, huh? That was a breakthrough.
It takes a long time.
Did you ever think, boy, what am I doing? You know, this is crazy.
Never. Yeah. Never looked back. Never thought about that. We always kept busy. We always worked hard. We always enjoyed what we were doing.
I got to believe your upbringing, not having a lot of money, the sense of responsibility that Mel was given obviously played a big role in your success. I mean, you were driven, willing to work, that kind of thing, as opposed to if you had grown up with a lot of wealth, it would have been different probably.
Would have been easier.
You would have had connections, huh?
But, we can't, it happened the way it was supposed to happen, and it is rewarding when it happens that way.
What did your parents think when they moved out here? That had to be a huge culture shock for them.
That's right. We moved them out here in the mid-60s, and at that time my mother wasn't doing too well, but my father was, I think he was very impressed. If you asked him what his sons did, he'd said they build supermarkets. He wasn't sure about how much, but he was very proud.
And was your dad a tailor throughout his working career?
Yes.
Is that all he did?
Well, okay. That was his career when I knew him.
Okay.
When he was younger, he was into some other things.
When you were a kid, what kind of things did you do to earn money to help out the household? Were you able to do things?
It's interesting. We didn't have money, and they never really wanted you to work. They wanted you to go to school. And so I had a couple of odd jobs, but nothing to speak of.
Didn't Mel do some sales type things, or?
He was always selling something, yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, he got me selling encyclopedias.
You sold encyclopedias?
Yes, encyclopedias.
Like when you were in high school or older?
College.
College?
Yeah.
Which encyclopedia?
Britannica.
Now that's not easy. My mom did that. I mean, you're knocking on doors and people are slamming the door in your face.
Knocking on doors.
Yeah.
I remember we had a little survey that we'd take if they had children. And then that survey would lead to, in the very rare case, where they invite you in the house. And once you got in the house, when you spread out all this great knowledge and absolutely, state-of-the-art books for their children, and parents would spend money. And these were not wealthy neighborhoods we were in.
Mm-hmm.
But, everyone wants to take care of their children, so.
So you did pretty well with encyclopedias. Huh?
I only think I worked a few weeks. I made a couple of sales. I thought it was the best thing that ever happened, and went on to something else.
So you're in Indianapolis. I take it there was never any thought about going anywhere else. There was never a time when you thought, oh, let's go back to New York or let's try someplace else. You had it going here pretty early, didn't you?
Yeah. I never looked back, as I said. It's different. Now I really enjoy New York when you have in my position. When before that, I'd never really enjoyed New York. I was mostly in the Bronx, and I never enjoyed all the great things in New York as much as I do today.
Do you go back to your old neighborhood some, or go back to Yankee Stadium?
I did with my kids a couple of times.
Yeah.
But the building is gone now.
The Simon brothers build an empire and knowingly make a bad business move to keep the Pacers from moving to Sacramento when One-on-One continues. Welcome back to One-on-One. I'm Mark Monteith. Today's guest is Pacers owner Herb Simon, the man who, along with his brother Mel, kept the Pacers in Indianapolis in 1983. In this segment, Herb talks about his loud but loving relationship with Mel and how they were talked into buying the Pacers.
How were your personalities different, you and Mel? He seemed to be the more, I don't know how to describe it, but just a more maybe forceful personality. But you've always been the guy who kind of talked to the media and was the public face of the Simon business. How did your personalities differ and mesh as business partners?
Well, I think it's for outsiders to make that observation, but for some reason we complimented each other a great deal, and that led to some of our successes. But yeah. Someone else to explain that. But we worked together. We fought every day, and he made up with me every day. The big brother always makes up, and we always were on top of each other. Constructive criticism, you know, and each one of us made the other person better, I think. At least he made me better. I don't know if I made him better, but he made me a better person and a better businessman.
Yeah. So you're like basketball teammates. You complimented one another and made each other better. But you say a lot of arguments, you're a lot of fighting.
We're noted for some of our arguments. People would get concerned, and the next minute we'd be arguing, and they didn't understand that. But we just expressed ourselves differently than most Hoosiers at the time.
But I would guess you kind of grew up that way, although he was 8 years older, that you were kind of accustomed to that around the house.
We were very open with each other.
The real estate market here in the 1960s and 70s, that must have seemed wide open to you. I mean, were there many other people trying to do what you were doing? And did you just kind of see it as land of opportunity?
We just happened to be at the right place at the right time in the 60s when the expansion of retailing started. We weren't the first in the business, but we were one of the first. And it wasn't as easy as it looks, because although the opportunities were there, we didn't start with any money, and it was tough to raise money. Mm-hmm. And the rents were not very high, but construction costs were lower. Somehow we were able to build one after another.
Were there ever times when you thought, we may have to fold this business?
Oh, sure. In the 45 years, we've had a couple of crises. And you remember there was expensive money, when money was 18, 20%. Mm-hmm. And there were times when there was no money. I mean, there was... The cycles of retailing and business are such, and when you start with a smaller base, you've got to be very careful. We were lucky. We got through. We paid all the banks off. We don't owe anyone anything. And then, of course, we went public in the early 90s.
Was there a time when you kind of needed a lifeline from somebody to keep the thing afloat?
Absolutely.
And I think I read you started your first mall was Southgate Mall in Bloomington?
No. A few malls started at the same time. Technically, the first one that opened up was Fort Collins, Colorado.
Oh.
And I don't know how that. We were working with Montgomery Ward at the time. But shortly thereafter, Anderson, Bloomington, Kokomo. And we were, and those are the ones that were the very early malls.
And then from what I understand, in the 1980s, you were opening maybe about three a year around the country?
Maybe more sometimes.
Yeah, that must have been just crazy.
Well, we had a big staff at the time.
But I got to believe you're working probably 7 days a week, endless hours per day.
No.
You didn't?
We worked hard, but not 7 days a week. We had families, and the weekends were mostly families. Every now and then we had to do business.
So you kept the balance.
We tried to.
Yeah.
Very tough, but we tried to.
You talked about the personalities of you and Mel, how you meshed. Did you take certain responsibilities that you divided up, that I'll handle this part of it, you handle that part of it?
Yes. We both handled everything, but separately. In other words, it was Mel's deal or Herb's deal.
Oh, okay.
And I would criticize Mel's deal, and he certainly would criticize Herb's deal. And that's how people understood that, that's Mel's deal, you got to go to Mel. You got to come to her, and that's how the company worked for many years.
Okay. Now, your brother Fred was part of it for a while.
Absolutely. He came in, and he learned leasing real fast and became the most revered, leasing guy in the industry. He was well-beloved, did a great job for many years, and he decided to retire early.
He's lived
a great life. Mm-hmm. He's traveled the world. He's done well.
When was it he left the business? In the 70s sometime?
No, sometime in the 80s.
In the 80s, okay. You were living in Indianapolis throughout the 60s and 70s. Did you ever go to Pacers games as fans?
Sure. Back in the fairgrounds, I went back that far back.
Any particular memories of games that you attended or things that happened or anything like
that? No, my memory really starts when we bought the team.
Okay.
And the early days when we had to put a curtain up because we couldn't get anyone to come in.
You and Mel bought the team in 1983, and for people to understand what you were buying into, the team was coming off a season in which it had won 20 games and averaged about 4,800 fans for attendance. So that's what you bought. First of all, when you bought the franchise, Can you talk about how that happened? And did you feel like you just had to do it?
No.
Okay.
We were minding our own business. And the mayor and I think Jim Morris, Dave Frick, maybe someone else came into our office one day and said, the team is going to be sold and moved to Sacramento. Would you and Mel please consider buying the team? And we said, why? Well, we need it. Indianapolis needs a team. So most people who buy pro franchises really, really wanted it, and we just really backed into it. We did it almost as a civic responsibility.
Yeah.
Not to say that we haven't taken it seriously since. That's how it really started. The city needed someone to get the team going, to keep it here.
Tough decision? I mean, it had to be a difficult decision. Or did you just kind of feel pressured into it?
I just felt that it wasn't as much money as it is today, and the money was sort of reasonable, and I felt, why not? I can't recall exactly my feeling, but it wasn't, I got to do it. It was, gee, we should do it.
Yeah.
And we did it.
Was it a case where one brother had to talk the other into it?
No. I said, Mel, here's the situation, and Mel didn't say no.
Did you feel it was a good business decision?
No.
Okay.
And we were right, also.
That's right.
Proves that's right.
When one-on-one continues, the Simons helped turn the Pacers into a competitive NBA franchise. But first, here's former Indianapolis Mayor Bill Hudnut on the city's efforts to convince the Simons to buy the team.
Dave Frick and Jim Morris and I and Ted Boehm, a couple of others maybe, we looked around. We actually went to Florida once to visit with Dave Thomas on his yacht. He was the owner of Wendy's, the franchise, a fast food franchise. He didn't go for it. We tried the Holman family. They didn't go for it. Finally, we went to Mel and Herb Simon, who had made a substantial commitment to Indianapolis. At that time, we were beginning to build the or make plans for the Circle Center project. And I had met the Simons a few years earlier, courtesy of Dick Tinkham, a lawyer in town. And so we had a bit of a relationship. And a couple of us went over to see, I can't remember whether Mel was in the room or not, but he certainly gave the okay. But we met with Herb and Randy Foxworthy, who was their chief numbers guy. And finally, at the end of the day, at the end of our hour together, Herb Simon sort of grinned and said, well, I got to do it, don't I? And I said, yeah, Herb, for civic pride. And they acquired, they acquired the franchise for its liabilities, which were somewhere in the neighborhood of $7 to $10 million. And, of course, the franchise is worth a lot more than that now, but the Simons have lost an incredible amount of money with the Pacers. And their civic generosity is just extraordinary.
Yes.
And I went to Mel's funeral along with 2,000 of his best friends, including Bill Clinton and Al Gore, Evan Bayh, because I was I felt so indebted to him for, you know, what he had done as the head of the organization to say, yep, we're going to stay in Indianapolis, we're going to make a commitment to Indianapolis, we're going to buy the Pacers.
Welcome back to One on One. I'm Mark Monteith. Today's guest is Pacers owner Herb Simon, who, along with brother Mel, is responsible for the franchise staying in Indianapolis. In this segment, Herb talks about those difficult early years with the Pacers and the difficult recent years as well.
There had to be times in those early years, like you say, they're drawing the curtain around the upper level of Market Square Arena, and you're bringing in 5,000 or 6,000 fans, and the team's not doing well. There had to be moments where you thought, what did we do? you know?
I don't know. At the time, I think losing was so depressing in the beginning. No, we just kept plugging along like anything else. We just kept working at it, and we had some very successful years.
But the team was close to moving to Sacramento, right?
It was the deal was actually done. Ready to be done, yeah.
So this was a last-minute thing. And there was
later on, they finally admitted to me, they went to about five or six other people who turned them down.
Do you feel like you were the last opportunity? There was probably nobody else in the city who could have done it?
Not at the time. We were confronted with that situation, and we felt that this is what, you know, the city has been good to us, and you got to give back sometimes.
Can you tell us how much money it took to buy the Pacers at that time?
Well, it's a very complicated deal, to be honest.
Because it included the arena, right? You also bought Market Square?
Actually, the rights to Market Square, yeah.
Okay.
I can tell you how much I lost, which I don't even want to tell you that, but it wasn't that expensive to buy it. But the operation of it has been challenging.
I've heard figures like between 12 and 16 million for the purchase. Is that in the ballpark?
You could say that.
Okay. So over the years, the franchise gradually grows from rock bottom. One of your breakthroughs, it would seem, was when you hired Donnie Walsh to be the general manager in 1986. Mm-hmm. He obviously had great success. How did you guys pick out Donnie? Because he was an assistant coach at the time, had never been a general manager. What was it that made you decide to hire him?
I brought in someone for an interview, someone with a big reputation. I don't want to mention his name. And someone else wanted me to meet him to run the team. And he said, this person, you got the guy right here, Donnie Walsh. So I said, okay. And we just moved him. So interviewing someone for the job, he's one that recommended Donnie Walsh. And I said, wow, right under my nose, I didn't even realize it. So
yeah, did you know Donnie very well at that time?
Just assistant coach, really.
Yeah. Well, Donnie's first year, drafts Chuck Person, hires Jack Ramsey, you make the playoffs, and that was the first time the franchise had made the playoffs in, I think, 6 years since before you bought the team. So there's kind of an immediate breakthrough there that had to be awfully gratifying as the owners to finally have some success.
You know, I forgot about that. Thanks for reminding me. That's a long time ago.
Yeah, 1987. That playoff appearance, and then there were some more years of struggle, though, and it really wasn't until Larry Brown came in that you advanced to the conference finals, and suddenly things really get going.
I think maybe Reggie coming in.
Reggie certainly helped.
Started.
Absolutely, absolutely. It takes
some of our good years. We had 18 years with Reggie, though.
Yes, and most of them were playoff years, the vast majority. So, but it takes so many things to come together. A player like Reggie, a GM like Donnie, getting the right coach.
All those things are very important.
Yeah. Can you compare it at all to a real estate business?
Every business deal is, you know, you got to put this different things together. You have a lot of different balls in the air, and you got to have them all mesh and work together. You know, I can't say my expertise in basketball is great, but after a while, you get to know what questions to ask, the right questions, and that's really that counts.
But right.
You do have to rely on the experts in basketball.
I think that's been one of the strengths of your ownership is that you haven't really meddled day-to-day, that you have turned it over to the GM or the coach and not stepped in and said, you got to fire this guy or whatever.
Well, if you recall, the first 20 years, actually, Mel and I were at the height of our careers, and we had very, other than being fans, we had very little, other than getting a call from Donnie, you know, for major decisions, we really didn't get involved in the team at all.
Yeah, didn't have time to.
No, but we never stopped being fans. We were at every game or watched every game, so. But we never interfered with the basketball.
Did you make any decisions? Did you ever tell Donnie, hey, I want you to hire this coach or anything like that?
No, Donnie would bring me into his thinking about it, and I invariably would go along with what he wanted to do.
You have said that, I think, you've only turned a profit on this thing a couple of years in all your years of ownership. Do you ever sit back and think, you know, what am I doing? You know, I mean, we were losing all this money. People, unless the team is a championship contender, you know, people seem to be mad at it all the time, and it's such a battle. Do you ever wonder?
It happened, it happened all of a sudden. I mean, the losses were not great over the years, and then a couple of things happened. We moved into a new arena. And we misjudged the cost and expense of operating the arena. And then we had the incidents that turned the fans off with some player off court and on court situations. And those two things, like the perfect storm, like the thing in Detroit was a perfect storm, all these different, it happened. And so the losses have been more severe in the last 5 or 6 years than they have been before. It was very tolerable. Now they're getting serious.
What enjoyment do you get out of being the owner of an NBA team besides when the team wins? I mean, what other satisfaction is there besides winning, if any?
Well, you know, the last couple of years I've taken an active role. And it's like a real estate problem. Here's a property that has some problems, and we got to fix it. And the enjoyment of having a serious problem and trying to rectify it is gratifying. I also enjoy my involvement with the league. I was chairman of the
Board of Governors.
Board of Governors, and I am on all the major committees and working with the league and expansion in China and all over. I'm on the China NBA China committee, so
okay.
The board of directors there. So I really enjoy some of the work we do with the league.
I know you've been good.
And excuse me to interrupt you, but we had the most exciting experience for many of our sponsors and ticket holders and our team when we went just recently to Taiwan and to Beijing to do two exhibition games.
Did you? That was good.
Yeah, everyone enjoyed it. Everyone thought it was a great experience. And
have you been to China several times?
Yes.
You like it there, huh?
Well, we have done work in China. We're building some real estate work in China, and we also now have the NBA China.
Right. Do you think the NBA will have teams in China before long?
Well,
or?
That's eventually, I think the NBA would like to have teams internationally.
Yeah, everywhere, huh?
Yeah.
There'll be some serious road trips. I can't imagine. We're going to play in China Tuesday. We'll be in...
Well, I don't know if we'll do it that way, but there'll be different leagues that will eventually maybe get together.
Like different divisions of the NBA?
Maybe. I don't know. This is way premature to talk about.
When One-on-One continues, Herb Simon discloses an upcoming event at Conseco Fieldhouse related to Reggie Miller and reflects upon the impact his parents had on his life. But first, here's former Pacers president Donnie Walsh on his relationship with Herb and Mel Simon, speaking shortly after Mel's death with Kravitz and Eddie.
Mel was like a force of nature. You know, I mean, he was just one of those guys that was going to be memorable. First of all, he was really bright and he was energetic. And, you know, I dealt with him in the world of basketball. He probably spent, you know, almost all his time except for one half hour or maybe an hour or two to watch a game. Everything else was spent on real estate. Yet I would have meetings with him, and he would bring up something in basketball, and I can remember saying to him, you know, Mel, I've been in this my whole life, and I don't think I've ever thought of that, but you might be right. And I thought about that this guy could come out in a half-hour meeting with me and tell me something that I'd never even thought about. And he was that kind of guy, and he was a great owner. More importantly, he was a great citizen of Indianapolis. And just a great guy to be around because, as I said, he was like a force of nature. He was a bigger-than-life guy, and it's really sad to see him pass away.
Donnie, what do you recall about your first meeting with Mel Simon?
Well, the first meeting I had, I think I negotiated and all that with Herbie, and then I went out to dinner with Herb and Mel. And so we were eating dinner and talking about the team and what they wanted and all that kind of stuff, and at some point, Mel said to me, hey, Donnie, there's one other thing. We yell and scream a lot. Are you going to be all right with that? And I said, well, let me ask you a question, Mel. Can I yell and scream back? And he went, oh, yeah. I said, okay, that's fine. And I had fun. What I loved about Herb and Mel as owners were that they would tell me when I was wrong. And what they got me to do was, if I really believed in what I was doing, I'd fight back with them. And then they'd say, okay, well, then do what you want to do. But there were instances where I thought I wanted to do it, and just them questioning me, I'd say, you know, I think you're right. I don't think I should do this. So that, in that sense, for me, they were great owners. They added to what I was doing because they would question me and make sure that I was thought out whatever we wanted to do because it was money. They were willing to put money into the team at all the time. They didn't seem to be asking for anything, you know, back in return, other than the excitement when the team was good and go to the finals of the East or when we went to the finals. You know, that was their payback. And I think they enjoyed what it did to the city during those times more than anybody because, You know, that's really what they got into it for. But as they went on, you know, I think Mel had been around the game of basketball, and then Herbie, through the ownership, you know, he got to know the game of basketball, and I think they got enjoyment. At least I hope so. I hope that Mel got a lot of enjoyment out of the times we had together.
Oh, he sure did. Every time you looked up in the suite at Conseco or over at MSA, when you always sat in the same seat. And boy, he used to help you get on the referees, didn't he?
Well, I was just thinking of that, because when you bring me to the games and I think of Mel, I can remember him running out on the court with his glasses to give them to the referee.
Welcome back to One-on-One. I'm Mark Monteith. Now, don't forget, you can catch this and many other episodes of One-on-One on our website at 1070thefan.com. Just click on the One-on-One window at the bottom of the homepage, and you'll have access to interviews with many notable Indiana sports personalities. Now back to Herb Simon, who will let you know about an upcoming event at Conseco Fieldhouse related to Reggie Miller and reflect upon the impact of his proud but humble parents.
What would you say has been your highlight as the owner? Was it the trip to the finals in 2000, or have there been other things that stand out as the best moments for you?
Well, I think with Reggie, you know, hitting those three-pointers, and I guess the 2000 season, Larry coming in and doing a great job coaching, mm-hmm. was a highlight.
Some of the Pacers' greatest moments have come against the Knicks in Madison Square Garden, certainly for Reggie. Having grown up a Knicks fan, did you take extra satisfaction in that, going back to New York and beating the Knicks like that?
Well, no, not extra satisfaction, but as a matter of fact, on February 26th, here, right here at Conseco, they're going to be the first showing of this documentary that has been produced showing Reggie versus the Knicks versus Spike Lee. That whole rivalry is in an hour and 15-minute documentary, which we're going to show. The first one right here.
Really? In the arena?
Yeah.
And is it open to all fans?
I'm sure they're working on it, whether it's going to be for charity or not. We're not sure.
Okay.
I think it's going to be probably a charitable
situation. Oh, good. February 26th.
Yep.
Will Reggie be here?
Yep.
Great. You still keep in touch with Reggie, don't you? You still?
As a matter of fact, I have coffee with him every now and then. Yeah, after all, he worked 18 years with us, so.
Yeah. Is that out in California or?
Yeah, mostly in California.
Because you have a home out in that area, right?
Yes.
And you just mentioned the last couple of years, you have become more involved in the day-to-day operations. You are now the sole owner of the franchise.
Yes.
Is this something that you've really enjoyed, doing the dirty work of it, so to speak?
It's a challenge. Mm-hmm. It's a challenge, and challenges excite me. Mm-hmm. It's still hard work.
The Simons are known for their generosity. I mean, you did a lot of things, not only saving the Pacers, but just a lot of charitable things in the city, things you didn't have to do. Where does that come from? Where does that mindset come from?
I think it started with Melvin, and Melvin always felt that we should give back, and we've tried to follow that lead. You know, when a place is good to you, you got to give back. And he always felt the more you give, the better it'll come back to you, and it worked out.
I have to believe that as you look back on your childhood, that it was probably great training ground for what you've achieved today. The close relationships with the family, not having a lot, so you have a hunger for more, that type of thing. Fair to say? Or?
I'm not sure if that's fair to say. I'm saying that so far it's been, you know, we've been lucky.
Yeah.
And good hard work and luck and good timing is, mm-hmm. and I guess family is important. And my great brother, two great brothers, I mean, couldn't have asked for anything better than two brothers like I have. We're going to miss Melvin deeply.
Fred is alive, right?
Oh, yes.
Where does he live?
In Palm Springs in Chicago.
Okay. What do you expect to happen to the franchise? You know, you're the sole owner now. What are your plans for beyond your ownership? Do you have any?
Well, just to live forever and own the Pacers forever. How's that?
That's a good plan, but you may need a backup.
I'm working on the backup.
Okay. I mean, do you want to keep it in the family, or do you see the day when you might
The most important thing is, to keep it in Indianapolis.
Yeah.
And, you know, this is the struggle that we're dealing with, smaller market and everything, but this team belongs in Indianapolis, and I'm going to do everything in my power to keep it in Indianapolis. And whoever succeeds me and my family will have the same feeling, I promise you.
Was there ever a time in all your years of ownership, including when it was really going well, that you had chances to sell it and considered selling it?
We've had chances, but we never really seriously considered it.
So you've had some offers over the years?
Yes.
Also, you know, a lot of times when a family owns a franchise and somebody passes away, it has to be sold just for estate purposes. Somewhere along the line, there must have been some very careful estate planning to allow you to keep it in the family.
Well, to me, quite frank, when Melvin was starting to get sick, he decided that it was a good time for him to sort of back off, and we made some estate planning decisions then, so we don't have to face that.
How involved are you in the real estate side of things now? Do you have much to do with that?
No, I'm on the board, and I do some international work, and I'm around for advice. But that's
okay.
No day-to-day stuff.
But your day-to-day involvement is now with the Pacers as opposed to Simon Properties.
When I'm in town, I usually go to both offices
every
day.
Are you enjoying the Pacers side of it any more than you thought? Or is it?
Well, if we win a few more ball games, I'm going to be enjoying it a lot more.
Do you kind of, you know, coaches certainly and GMs, I mean, do you sweat out the games like everyone else? I mean, are you watching the road games on TV?
I'm not pleasant to be with during the game. I'm usually very tense. And even 20 points ahead in the third quarter doesn't make me relax.
Because you've been around long enough to see those leads disappear.
Absolutely.
You are good friends with David Stern, the commissioner of the NBA.
Yes.
And similar backgrounds. He's from New York. When the brawl happened and he made the decisions to suspend players like that, did it put kind of a strain on your relationship for a while?
Well,
because that was a huge blow to the franchise.
It was. I had plenty of opportunities to present my case forcefully, but the strength of the league is, you know, a strong commissioner, and that doesn't mean you always win your arguments, but I felt the punishments were harsher than they could have been.
Yeah, and you had a lot of conversations with David about that,
yes.
Obviously. Did he ever claim that, well, you know, in retrospect, maybe I overreacted, or?
I cannot, no comment.
Fair enough. Is there a favorite story from your childhood that you liked to talk when you're with the family, or when you and Mel would sit down and talk? Are there certain memories or stories that you like to bring up and enjoy the most?
Well, I think when we used to get the biggest kick out of some of the things my father would say, which at the time were embarrassing or strange, but in retrospect, he was almost a philosopher. So we would laugh at some of the things he would say. I can't repeat them here, but they were funny and incisive.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, we thought, you know, he didn't speak the language that great, but he was a wise man, and it only took years when we reflect on it as brothers that we realized our father was a special guy.
What was your mother's role? I mean, what did you take from your mother?
My mother was all-loving, all-giving. If you came in at 2 in the morning, she would yell at you for being late and then make eggs for you or whatever you wanted to eat. And she was forgiving and warm, warm, loving mother.
I have kind of a theme song for everyone. I mean, what kind of music do you like best? Or is there a song that's a favorite or anything, or an artist? Or?
Well, actually, I drive my kids crazy when I sing Take Me Out to the Ball Game. Somehow, when I want to kid around with them, that's what I sing.
Do you have any particular memories of going to Yankee Stadium with your dad? And any games or players?
I'll never forget. There was in the late 40s. There was a first, you know, the relief pitchers became into vogue then.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Fireman Joe Page or something they used to call him. And he was the best relief pitcher of his time. And it was a packed stadium and 50,000 people in Yankee Stadium. And we sat in the bleachers, of course. And I remember him striking out the side or something like that. So that's a fond memory with my father.
Okay. I appreciate your time.
Enjoyed it. You're very easy to talk with.
No, I enjoy this. It's great just to sit down and get to know people, and I think the people who hear the shows like hearing about the childhoods. And you know what I found is that their common theme is that most of the really successful people, whether it's Larry Bird, Oscar Robertson, yourself, grew up in very humble surroundings, but had a great family situation, and they grew up with a real desire to achieve something, and there's almost a formula there for that. It's just interesting. You know, Bird obviously didn't grow up with any advantages, and Oscar Robertson's dad was a butcher, and George McGinnis's dad was a construction worker, and it just seems like almost everyone I talk to has a similar story like that. Nobody really grew up with a lot of advantages, and you know, people live the American dream.
That's what it's all about.
One-on-One continues in a moment. Back to close up this episode of One on One, I'm Mark Monteith. If you caught Herb Simon's explanation for his choice of the theme music this week, you know why I'm playing Take Me Out to the Ball Game. Although he and Mel owned a basketball team and not a baseball team, the song's appropriate anyway. Because without the Simons, there would have been a lot fewer ball games for fans in Indianapolis to be taken out to over the years. Without the Simons, there would be no Pacer franchise, and maybe no Colts either. Now don't forget, this episode and many others are available via podcast on our website at 1070thefan.com. Just scroll to the bottom of the homepage, click on the one-on-one window, and you'll have access to conversations with all kinds of Indiana sports personalities. And I'll be back next week with yet another one, right here on 1070 The Fan.